So, Damon, just imagine for a second that you wake up on a Sunday morning and you go, what am I going to do today? And you think, I tell you what, I'm going to go to the Goodwood Festival of Speed. Then I'm going to go to the Wimbledon final. And then I'm going to go to the final of the Euro 2020. That was Mr. Tom Cruise on Sunday. Extraordinary, isn't it?
It is extraordinary. But I have another possible explanation, which is, you know, he has his stunt double. So he does his own stunts, doesn't he? How do we know which one was the Tom Cruise, the real Tom Cruise? You know what they're like in Hollywood?
Well, I can answer that. His stunt double was at Goodwood, wasn't he? And he's a man called Wade Eastwood, who looks like a 50-year-old Clint Eastwood, and he looks nothing like Tom Cruise. So there's absolutely no doubt whether it was Tom Cruise or Wade. They look nothing like each other. But I mean, that's a pretty cool Sunday to do Goodwood, Wimbledon, Euros, isn't it? What's the coolest day you've ever had in that respect?
Oh, I think probably when I think I might have won the German Grand Prix and then flown in with my private jet to land at Malaga and go and see the Rolling Stones on the mixing disc. Is that all right?
Knocked him out of the water there, mate. Yeah. That's great.
I think that was one of the perks of being a Formula One racing driver that you don't forget. You should get a stunt double. Basically, you're starting to get look exhausted, Tom. I mean, you've been doing that. You've been on the go now, week in, week out. All these back-to-backs, these triple headers. And then you go straight into the British Grand Prix next weekend.
Can you be my stunt double?
I could definitely have a go. I think I could, I mean, what sort of stunts do you want doing? I'm not doing the press conference. No.
Can you at least start the show for us? Give me a break there.
So this is the F1 Nation broadcast, pre-British Grand Prix, post that event that involves a round football, which we won't talk about, but we're pre the British Grand Prix. So we're all looking forward to the British Grand Prix and its new format of qualifying, which we're going to talk about a little bit in later. And we've got a special guest.
All of the above. And I'm not going to mention Sunday night, but I'm kind of hoping Ferrari have a bad weekend at Silverstone because I feel they deserve that. I feel the nation of Italy deserves a bad weekend after what happened on Sunday.
I can't believe you just said that. We are going to give the most fantastic welcome at Silverstone, as we always do. We love Ferrari. We love the Italians. But we can talk a little bit about how it was at the Festival of Speed because we had another Italian there, Italian extracted person, Mario Andretti. What did he have to say for himself?
Oh, Damon, it was really fantastic to catch up with him. And actually, at one point on Sunday, he drove Alberto Ascari's 1954 Ferrari that Mario had seen him drive at Monza that year. And as he said to me just before he got in the car, he said, that was the moment I had no plan B. There was only a plan A, and that was to be a racing driver. And it is this car, this actual car, that is responsible for that. So it was a powerful moment, actually. And you could see he was getting quite emotional. More emotional, he said, than driving the Lotus 79 that is owned by Zak Brown. And he drove that up the hill as well. But it was this Ascari Ferrari that really did it for him. What was your highlight, though? I saw you driving various things.
Well, I was lucky to get asked to drive another couple of my dad's cars. There was the Shadow, which was his car from his team. So it's the first car that he raced as a Formula One team entrant, which is the Shadow, 1973 car. And they were basically a customer car because I think Jackie Oliver sold him. He had the license to sell these Shadow cars. And so my dad bought one of those, and that was a kind of off-the-shelf thing before he went into being a manufacturer. He started buying Lolas, and then he kind of modified them, and then they became full entrant Graham Hill cars, and they were going to be raced in 76, but unfortunately they never made it to that point. So the 73 car was quite an unusual looking car. It's sort of quite bulbous and round, but in those days they were just getting to the grips with aerodynamic shapes and stuff. But aluminium chassis, you know, Cosworth engine. And I got asked to drive it, and they had the crew all kitted out in embassy colours, because embassy were a cigarette, and I don't know if they still are, but anyway, we don't talk about cigarettes because we don't smoke them anymore. So, but they had them all kitted out in 1970s fashion, shall I call it.
When you're going up the hill at Goodwood, do you get a feel for a car, or is it just too slow and the there's too much camber on the road or something.
It was greasy as anything, but you get a good blast off the line. I like that, you know, do a bit of snaking up the road a bit. But I'm just conscious it's not my car. I don't want to stack it into a blooming hay bale. In fact, when we got to the top of the hill, there was a bit of a worrying silence while they worked out what one of the cars had gone off and barrel rolled. It was a USG Arrows, I think, that had a big shunt. But I think the guy was okay.
Yeah, he was okay, but car certainly wasn't, was it? Yeah.
The car wasn't, no. So, you know, when you sit at the top of the hill and you've got Jackie Stewart and Mario Andretti and all these great names, and Danny Rick was there, and so he was in a Senna McLaren MP44.
It wasn't any old Senna McLaren. It was the 5B from 1990, and it was the actual chassis in which Senna rammed Prost at turn one at Suzuka to win the world championship that year. And it still had the FIA scrutineering sticker stuck to the side of the cockpit. So that's quite a special car. I enjoyed seeing that. One name you didn't mention who I really enjoyed catching up with was Roger Penske, the captain. He'd brought 11 Penske cars over from America to sort of celebrate his career from a NASCAR in which he won at Riverside 50 years ago himself, because, of course, Roger was a driver back in the day. And then, of course, a lot of Indy cars. John Watson was there driving the 1976 Penske in which he won the Austrian Grand Prix as well. So it is special, Goodwood. And how they managed to get so many great names together is... It's one big garden party, and when it rains, funnily enough, like it did on Saturday, I always think it doesn't work that well. It's sort of, they should have some cricket rule that when it rains, rain stops play.
Yeah, I think we'd lose an awful lot of days of Festival of Speed, I think, if you had a rain rule like that. So I think that the fans, you know, it's like Glastonbury, welly boots, you know, you get out there and you get stuck in. It was a bit muddy, but yeah, what a summer we're having. Absolutely shocking. So I'm really hoping that this is going to be the end of it and we'll get this fantastic weather we're owed, because we've had some rough weather in the UK. I know you've been flying around and getting some sunshine, but Silverstone, be nice to get a bit of sunshine.
Mm. Just before we move on to Silverstone, there was one more moment from Goodwood, which I loved, which was the Murray Walker moment, of which you were integral, Damon, because you read a very nice speech down at the start line about Murray, and then it cut to some Murray Walker commentary, and the whole place, 50,000 people, went silent. And just to hear Murray screaming out over the loudspeaker again, because... of course, for those who don't remember, we lost Murray, aged 97, back in March. It was poignant and lovely to hear his voice again.
Yeah, it seems incredible that he's not around anymore. But shame I didn't hear those classic moments. I'd like to hear them, but I was clambering into my car because I had to go up the hill immediately after the reading. So, you were very good, Tom. You said I'd got it right. You said you nailed it, Hill.
You did nail it.
That was good. It was an emotional read, and I had to stop myself from breaking out into a Murray Walker impression.
Oh, I've got a lump in my throat.
So happy memories, and great to send him off and do a tribute like that, which is what they do brilliantly. They had also an engine rev, didn't they, for Carlos Reutemann? So, it's never a moment lost at Goodwood to remind us of some of the great names in the sport when we've lost people. So he got a good send off. And Gordon Murray was there with one of Carlos Reutemann's cars, but it wasn't the actual car. It was Gordon's car. Bernie owns the original. So he thought, well, I'll just make one for myself. So it's actually one he designed and built. It's a brand new BT, whatever it was, that Carlos raced. So one of the first Brabhams.
I think it was the 75 car. You've slightly burst my bubble, because I was looking at that car thinking, isn't it gorgeous? And now it's actually...
Well, I did. I looked at it and I thought, that looks brand new. And it was. It was absolutely fantastic.
Funnily enough, there was a six-wheeler there as well, the P34 six-wheeler, with Jody's name written down the side. And I was thinking, oh, isn't it wonderful to see that? I wonder if that's Jody's actual car. And the guy who was driving it said, no, mate, it's new. It's brand new, actually. Yeah.
Okay, so watch out. Anyone out there who's looking at old Formula One cars, and just check it's not been made yesterday. The paint's still wet.
With the P34, fun enough, they'd actually gone to the Tyrrell family and got hold of all of the original drawings for the car. So he said, right down to the rivets, it's identical. Mm. To the thing that Derek Gardner designed, but it's not an original. It was built 2 years ago. So.
Yeah. Anyway, we're done with Goodwood. I think I was only in and out for a day, but I had a nice time, nice chat, meet people like Mario and stuff.
And it is a wonderful warm-up for the main event, isn't it? Which always follows the following weekend, the British Grand Prix. Damon, when did you first go to the British Grand Prix? It must have been a wee while ago.
It was a while ago. You just reminded me, there's one more event to go before we get to the British Grand Prix, which is my karting event at Sandown Park when this podcast comes out.
Oh, tell us more. Tell us more. What's happening?
It's a charity karting event. I've been doing it for a few years. It's Damon Hill's Karting Challenge, and we raise money for my charity. And so it's been well, it's oversubscribed actually now, so it's brilliant.
And what are you raising money for?
Halo, which is a charity that supports young people with learning disabilities. It provides activities and learning opportunities and confidence building activities. And Johnny Herbert is coming to support us, and he's entering a team, and I've got to beat Johnny in the karting challenge.
Well, not just you and Johnny racing each other. Do all the punters, they must think, right, I have to overtake Damon Hill if it's the last thing I do.
Yeah, and it probably will be.
It's like you've got crosshairs on your back.
No, exactly. I am a target. I go around and there's some people bashing into me and knocking me off the track. It's absolutely carnage.
Fantastic. Well, good luck with that.
Yeah, so that'll be out of my system, and I'll be able to go into Silverstone with, you know, hopefully not too many bruises.
Well, it's going to be fantastic to have you at a race again, because you're going to be there in person.
Yeah, I am.
When was your first trip to Silverstone?
My first trip to Silverstone, I don't know, because I probably was a baby. I would have been there probably in my mother's womb, because my dad started racing I was born in 1960, so she would have been at the British Grand Prix in 1960, because my dad was racing in it. So then I would have been going there, but the first time as a driver, I didn't start driving until the 80s, but yeah, I went there for every summer holiday. It was like we broke up from school and then went to Silverstone and watched my dad race, or just knocked about the paddock. That's where I basically discovered motorbikes, was at Silverstone. So a few years later, I had a motorbike, which I used to do wheelies. I used to go wheeling down the paddock on my trials bike.
What, just to get around during the British Grand Prix, you'd have a motorbike?
It was a free-for-all. If you had a ticket to get in the centre, you could almost go anywhere. So people were just wandering around, and where there was a bit of spare time or whatever, I'd go out on my bike and do a few wheelies for people. And it was totally different in those days.
But of course, your dad never won the British Grand Prix, whereas you did, didn't you? 1994.
Yeah, I did. So I've collected the important trophy for the Hill cabinet. So yeah, he never won. He won Monaco five times, but not the British Grand Prix. I think he was a bit unlucky in 62. I think it was. He ran out of brakes, or 61. But no.
Of the 22 wins in your career, is that one at Silverstone the most special?
Well, it's one of those important ones, because it is your home Grand Prix. And it was also, the trophy was presented by Princess Diana. And it was, you know, controversial race, because it was one where Michael Schumacher, overtook me and then got black flagged and then didn't come in. And then there was all this kind of tension around the event, being 94 as well, with the, just after Imola, it was extra tense. So I did feel the pressure at that race. So I can kind of relate to being in the hot seat. And it was the first time I'd really been in a championship contending position going into the British Grand Prix. So the pressures that come to bear on drivers in a battle for a championship are different, especially when you're racing at home. And I remember the questions and the things they make up out of a quote, you know, was all a bit of a shock to me, because I said one or two things about Michael, and before I know it, there's all this stuff over the back pages of the newspapers, you know, trying to whip up all of the tension before the race. But it was an interesting experience, 94.
But DH, can I say, I think you brought some of that upon yourself, because was it 94? There's a photograph of you stood on the pit wall. I think giving Michael a hand signal as he drove past.
Yeah, so you lark around, and then before you know it, it's turned into, it's not so funny anymore, because it looks like you're serious. And as we know in sports, you don't need much to offend the opponents and the opponent's supporters, because it's not taken quite in the way it was intended. So a lot of lessons to be learned from 94. And that's part of the job of a Formula One driver, is understanding the things you say and do are also going to be perhaps used against you in evidence.
So, that was also your second full season. Did you feel that the media in 93, year one, were a bit more gentle on you because it was your first year and everyone was...
Yeah, I think so. 93, it was...
Yeah.
There was a little bit of... I was lucky to be there because, you know, I was just filling a gap because Nigel had gone off and I was only number two to Alan Prost. So I wasn't the main meat of the story. But of course, after Imola, when we lost to Eton, you know, I was sort of thrown into the gap that was left by Eton in terms of certainly within the team at Williams. And so I was much more in a high profile position. And that was all new experience to me. And I had no proper knowledge of how to deal with those kind of pressures. I had to learn the hard way.
Was it exhausting?
Yeah, I think it was exhausting. I think it was exhausting because it involved extra work in trying to work out. You have to have a strategy of what you're going to say and what you know, how you're going to approach the weekend and how you deal with all these extra interest. Williams were not set up in those days. Now you have press people that are trying to protect the driver. And so I didn't have anyone doing that. I mean, there was Anne Bradshaw there at Williams, but and she was very good, actually. She was very good at ticking off the tabloids when they needed ticking off. But they're after a story, you know. And so you... I remember one back page, there was a guy who worked for the Mirror. I was getting cross about something. And so I stormed off at the end of it and they chased me. And this guy with a camera sort of gets the journalist and me, and he's trying to talk to me, and I'm sort of walking off, and I'm looking a bit cheesed off. And I took a picture of this. It looked like a dramatic moment. And then the back page of the paper, and the next day it said, "He's gone nuts." And that was it. Full back page of me looking like a person who has lost control of himself.
Damon, it's really interesting hearing how you deal with these pressures at the British Grand Prix. So now is a great time to bring in our special guest. We haven't actually mentioned his name so far on the show. It is George Russell, racing at home. He's in the waiting room. Shall we let him in?
Of course, bring him in. Oh, look, I can see him.
How are we doing, guys?
Hey, there he is. George, great to have you on the show. Thank you very much.
Looks like he's in a factory, Tom.
I am in a factory. I'm currently at Williams doing our prep ahead of the weekend. So slightly different to normal, a bit more emphasis onto the races. Obviously, we've got the sprint qualifying, is officially called. Is it sprint qualifying or not a sprint race, a sprint qualifying? So, of which is a race. So a bit more emphasis onto that.
And, can you not use the word race, please? We've been told not to use the word race. Yeah. It's a race, but it's not a race.
It's a qualifying race, I guess.
It's a heat. Is it a heat?
I like that. A pre-final. When I used to race karting, we used to have a pre-final and then the grand finale. So maybe that could be...
I like that one, though. We should call it the grand finale on Sunday.
And which one of those was the race? Sorry, George, I'm getting confused. Which one of those was the race?
The grand finale was the race. The pre-final was the pre-race. So that was the equivalent of the sprint qualifying. But anyway, slightly different this weekend, but no, really excited.
It's going to be very exciting. But look, before we come on to all that, George, Damon's just been talking about the pressures of racing at home, and particularly when he won at Silverstone back in 94 with everything that had gone on earlier in the year. Do you deal with Silverstone any differently from a press point of view? Do the team help you prepare in terms of what you need to say or not say?
I think from my side, in terms of on track, I never like to approach a weekend differently, whether in the past it was fighting for a championship or whether it was a home race or a new event. You know, you've got a set routine. I think keeping that routine is really important. And just because it is my home race, you always give your extra. So I always think when people say, "I'm going to try a bit more," well, why weren't you trying a little bit more the previous week or the other 22 races? So there's nothing more I think a driver can give purely because it's a home race, because you're given your absolute maximum. But I think that additional excitement of being in your home race does naturally give you a bit more enthusiasm. So maybe that's where the extra performance comes from. But I think the difficult bit, I guess, is there's a lot of media scrutiny and a lot of activities going on during that week, and just balancing that out, really, because it is the biggest, from a marketing perspective, the biggest event of the year for us. But ultimately, we can't let that have an effect on the racing. So just finding that right balance.
The line, George, if I can just help you here, is the crowd give me another second a lap. That's what you say. That's what you say at the British Grand Prix. If it wasn't that brilliant, the British fans are going to give me at least another second a lap. And that's
what I mean. I think the crowd do give you that extra lap time because you naturally just have this more energy within. I guess it's like if you have a good night's sleep, you wake up, you're feeling pumped and you feel ready. You're not more or less talented, or you're not going to work more or less hard than you did the previous week, but you're just in a better state of mind and in a better space to go out there and do the business. And I guess when you're in front of your home crowd, they're all there buzzing, cheering you on. And that is just going to overrule everything and just, you know, make you perform at an even higher level.
Because you're actually man of the moment a bit, aren't you? Because there's all this speculation about where you're going to be going. Is there going to be an announcement this weekend? And Tom's got a question for you, haven't Tom?
I have. Have you signed for Mercedes, George?
I straight in there.
Damon and I, a very slick team. Did you see the way we teed that up? We work well together.
I pass the responsibility over to Tom for that question.
I signed with Mercedes 5 or 6 years ago now. That is 100% true. As everybody knows, they look after me. But with regards to my drive for next year, nothing has been signed or sealed and nothing will be announced in Silverstone. So I can let you know that.
Mm. I feel that's a bit of an exclusive because we've all been thinking, it's going to be announced at Silverstone. They announced Lewis a couple of weeks ago, ready for the George announcement at Silverstone, but it's not going to come.
Let's let the heat off him a little bit, Tom, and say, you know, the experience of being with Williams as your first port of call, if you like, on Formula One, your kind of launch pad. I mean, you've clearly done a fantastic job. The team like having you there. What about, I mean, staying with the team? Because it's got a new structure. It's got Jos Capito and it's got some great people being drafted in now. What's the future look like if you were to stay at Williams, for example?
I mean, I've said this numerous times. I think the change of structure and everything that's going on at Williams is incredibly exciting. Obviously, the team have finished last for the past 3 years in a row. I'm pretty confident that will not be the case next year. Things are really making a turn for the better. Things are really getting in line and in place. You know, Jos is doing a fantastic job building that structure for everybody to be more efficient, more streamlined. And every single decision that's been made so far, I think, has been a good one for the right reasons. And I see no reason why, you know, over the course of the next number of years, Williams can't fight their way back to the front. And, you know, that might sound silly or stupid now, but you've only got to look back at, I think it was 2013, when Valtteri and Maldonado were in the car. They finished 9th or 10th in the Constructors and came out the following year and finished 3rd. You know, podiums, most races, pole positions. This sport can change in a heartbeat when you've got this big regulation change. And fingers crossed for Williams, it changes for the better.
And these last three races, there's been an extraordinary turnaround. I think of your 12th place in France. Great drive. No retirements, unfortunately, in front of you. Then you retired, of course, the next race. But then last weekend, I felt everyone was disappointed with 11th. You know,
we were. We definitely were. I think you know, we've got a few indications as to why these past three weekends have been so strong. Fingers crossed we can keep this form up, to be honest. You know, it's not going to be quite that simple. It never is when you're performing on the absolute top of your game. That is really difficult to do week in, week out in any sport. I think Silverstone and Budapest are going to be the real test for us if that pace we showed over the past three races was true, or it was a bit of a one-off or a couple of circumstances that played in our favour.
So is it car setup, or have you had has there been some upgrade that came prior to France?
Well, I'd say in Austria, the two races, you know, we've been quite vocal about how wind sensitive our car is. The two races in Austria, there were absolutely zero wind whatsoever. So that played into our advantage. In France, it was a very heavily tyre dominated race. You know, everybody was managing the tyres. Was it a one stop? Was it a two stop? Lots of graining going on. And we just did a fantastic job of pushing the tyre to the limit, but not over the limit. Suddenly there, you can put a reason as to why we had an uplift in performance in those three events. there have been things in the background we've changed, and I think they've changed for the better. You know, we've brought little things to the car that has improved it. With my engineers, we've improved the setup slightly. We've gone in a slightly different direction, which I think has been beneficial. So it's sort of a number of little things all coming together, which really gave us a big uplift in performance, especially in Austria.
Do you feel like you've grown in confidence within the working relationships that you've got within the team? Because I've noticed, and one of the things I am not sure about with the sport is I hear a lot of coaching from the engineers about how to drive and stuff. And my question is whether or not really it should be the other way around, with the drivers actually saying to the engineers, I want this, I want that. And you've seen some drivers, I mean, Fernando, I can't imagine really just doing what he's told, the guy that gave you a fantastic vote of confidence after Austria. And you just get the idea that if you can take charge, are you feeling like you're getting to that point where you can say, guys, I want this from the car? Or is that not how Formula One works?
It absolutely is. I think there's enough trust and loyalty between all of us that if I feel strongly about a certain thing, people will listen, and vice versa. If my engineers feel strongly about a certain philosophy or set of direction, then, you know, we have a very open mind. And I think that's what's so important, because it's constantly evolving, Formula One. You go to different races, different conditions, windy, not windy, different compounds of tyres, different weather, and you've got to be adaptable. And I think what is so clear is something may have worked last week, but that doesn't mean it's going to work this week. And you can learn bits and bobs from that, but I think you just need to learn to be adaptable. And that's really key. But I think definitely, you know, over these past 3 years, I've grown such a great relationship with the team. I feel like I'm, you know, we're sort of working as one. We all know exactly what we do. We don't say things for the sake of saying it. And everything we talk about, there's a real valid reason as to why we do that. And I think that's why I think we're extracting so much from our car. I'm pretty confident there's not that many more people, driver and team combination, so we're probably extracting as much out of the package as we are. I think the team are doing a fantastic job.
While we're talking almost sort of work ethos and culture, how do you feel, George, those aspects have changed since Dorrelton took over from the Williams family?
Well, I think the biggest thing is there's been less pressure of sort of the team's survival as such. You know, the team previously were really struggling financially, and it was basically doing everything we can just to save money and keep the team afloat. And that's obviously not going to help with performance. You know, this is a performance-dominated sport. You've obviously got to be in it to win it to start with. So that was absolutely the right decisions to be made back then. But since the new owners have come on board, you know, the finances have been there. It's obviously not a bottomless pot, but it's definitely good finances to develop where is needed and invest the money where is needed. And, you know, the sole focus now is making the car go quicker and improving the infrastructure back at the factory, which, you know, is so key, especially when you're fighting against guys who probably had a more stable foundation than we did, and they could just purely focus on making the car go faster.
You seem to me to be a bit of a lone agent. You famously went in to see Frank with your briefcase and your kind of PowerPoint presentation as you saw your career. Are you still representing yourself? You know, you seem to me to be someone who wants to determine your own future. Am I right in that? You know, you want to be your own boss?
I wouldn't necessarily say my own boss, but I think when I was younger, I always had the thoughts of, you know, you've got to go out there and make it happen for yourself. You know, it's very rarely people come to you offering opportunities. It's quite often you've got to put yourself in the door and then the opportunities follow. And I guess that was how I got myself in the door at Williams. You know, I went to Hockenheim in 2018 and I literally managed to get hold of, it started with Paddy, actually, because I knew Paddy from Mercedes. I got his phone number and sent him a message and asked for a meeting with him and Claire, and you know, just put myself in front of him and started a conversation. But, you know, things are different now. I am a Mercedes driver. I'm incredibly loyal to Mercedes because they have stood by my side since day one. They've given me all of my opportunities, and I trust that they have my best interests at heart. But, you know, I always like to keep the relationship open with everybody, really. I never like to close any doors, and I'd never, if somebody asked for a conversation, I'd never say no, really. You never know what happens in the future, and things change pretty drastically. And I'm, you know, you've only got to look at, for example, Stefano. You know, he was the team principal of Ferrari, and now he's the CEO of Formula One. And I guess maybe 10 years ago, you may not have predicted that. Maybe you would have. I mean, I've only started to.
You can see yourself driving for Ferrari at some point, then. I mean, it's out of that, basically. You know, we don't know, do we? But you've got, you did mention Mercedes engines. Of course, there is another team that's got Mercedes engines at the moment, which is doing rather well with the other British driver, who's a good friend of yours. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, all things are there to play for, aren't they? Do you have to keep producing, you know, your tremendous results? I mean, do you feel like you've established yourself, or is there, is just you'd never let up?
You can never let up. I think this is the unique thing about Formula One. There's only 20 race seats in the world, and if you lose form and you start, you know, the results aren't coming in, and you somehow lost your seat, there's no guarantees you'll get it back. You know, in football, if you lose your form, you might be on the bench for a couple of weeks, but you can then prove yourself again in training. Or if it's tennis, you lose your form, you might drop down the world rankings to, instead of top 10, you're 25th. But then a year later, you work your way back up to the top five or world number one. Formula One, if you're 25th in the world, you don't have a job and you're out.
Damon, how long did it take you to feel that you were part of the Formula One establishment?
I'm not sure. I don't know where. I think I was always fighting to feel like I was, actually. I think maybe when I went to Jordan, I kind of felt like I was a bit more number one in that team, maybe. It's really interesting that you've had this bump in the road with Imola, because, you know, you actually had a moment there where it was only not even 6 months before, it was all looking fantastic after coming back out of Bahrain, you know, with that tremendous performance that you put in there that had me jumping out of my seat when I was watching. It was fantastic. And then suddenly it's like, bang, down to earth, Imola. So you've had one of those emotional roller coasters that drivers go through. What point did you reflect on Imola, and how did you grapple with that? Because that can really get quite tough, I think, emotionally on drivers.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess that was a bit of a reality check, that in a split second, you know, you can almost go from hero to zero, and your whole perception potentially could be changed, and your whole future could be changed. I think that was a massive lesson for me, how to handle myself and sort of post-crash and in front of the media, even the crash itself, how things unfolded, whether it's the right move to go for or not, and just the whole circumstance. I'd like to think I can look back and say that was an important lesson for me, but I think I recognized very, very quickly that I couldn't afford to make errors like that. You know, everybody has their own view. If it was his fault, my fault, I've obviously got my own views and my own reasonings why I went for that, but going for a move is one thing, but then how you deal with the aftermath of it not panning out the way you wanted is a completely different story as well.
I think your resilience is clear to be seen there. That's you know, the talent shines through, but that those bumps in the road, I think, make you tougher, don't they?
Absolutely. I think something my trainer, Alesha, always says to me, which I love, is that you're building your toolbox. You're growing that toolbox to delve into in the future whenever you need it. So, you know, I've had highs, I've had lows, I've gone through these experiences. So when I experience this again, maybe in 5 years or 10 years or in 1 year time, hopefully when I'm fighting for a world championship, I've had these positive and negative experiences to tap into when I need to and say, well, that's how I recovered from that certain situation last time, or that's how I handled myself then, and I'm going to do it differently now. And I think being in this position, generally fighting at the back of a grid, of which with a very difficult car, which is not easy to drive, you know, obviously jumping in the Mercedes, it was a joy to drive because it was the championship winning car, and it was so nice and it was so fast, versus a car that's, you know, a real battle just to get it around a lap. You know, I think I'm learning things more so than I would if I was in a car that you jump in, the car's perfect, it's fast, and you're winning.
George, I feel we should bring it on to this weekend's format. We touched very briefly on, we call it sprint qualifying, it's not a race. But can we actually go through the whole weekend in chronological order? Because Qualifying as we know it is going to be on Friday afternoon after just one practice session. So are you going to feel a bit undercooked going into qualifying without that second practice session?
But definitely, the more laps you do, there's no doubt you gain more experience and you're in a better shape. But I think from my side, I feel confident enough that the one session is sufficient. You know, I feel confident with the team that they'll give me a car that's there or thereabouts. But obviously the difficulty is if you have a problem, you know, it's happened a number of times before where a car has broken down or failed at the start of a session. That's going to really, really mess you up. So that's the only concern, I think, of only having the one session before what is one of the most important sessions of the weekend in qualifying.
And then 17 lap race, sprint qualifying. I've seen lots of people say, oh, the drivers are going to be really conservative. Oh, they're not going to risk it. Why would you risk it? You're not going to risk your grid slot. I think George Russell's going to go for it. What's he going to do? How are you going to play it?
If everybody's conservative, then it gives an opportunity to the one who's going to put a bit more out there. So obviously, if I were Verstappen or Lewis at the front of the grid, you're not going to go for a reckless overtake and risk not finishing the race because they can qualify in the top five or start in the top five for Sunday and still finish first or second. But in a position like us, when you're at the back of the grid, you got to go for it. So this is an opportunity because there are going to be people with having a different approach. You know, we've often been good in qualifying. If we can start ahead of some faster cars who are maybe going to play a bit more conservative than we are, or starting just behind some cars who are going to be a bit more conservative than we are, maybe that offers an opportunity. So I'm ready for it, to be honest.
What's the general feeling? Is this a good move, do you think? It spices up the show, worth a try? Or is there more negativity about it amongst the drivers, circumspection?
I think there's a mixed views. Personally, I think changing the format to have 3 days of action is great. You know, the fans deserve it. We deserve it. And that's what people want. You want to, if we can increase the number of days of action, then that's a win-win. So that's definitely a plus. On the flip side, I personally saw no issue with the old format. Obviously, that's only split across 2 days. So it's finding that right balance, really. So if you're looking at it from a pure performance and maybe a selfish perspective, then, you know, there was nothing wrong with the previous format. If you're looking at it from a global perspective and a sporting perspective, what will offer more entertainment to the fans, then moving to the sprint qualifying is definitely the way forward.
Bring it on, we say. I'm very excited about it.
I'm excited. I want to see this happen. I want to see it. I'm definitely going to be more interested in this weekend than I think I've been in a Formula One race for a very long time. And I'm always interested. So, you know, I'm keen to find out how this all is going to play. And it's going to be good.
George, have you got to do a runner or have you got 5 minutes?
I've got 5 minutes.
Because one of our favourite bits of the show is Ask Damon. Fans, leave a voice message and it can be anything, just to warn you. They ask Damon absolutely everything and it'd be great to get your thoughts on some of these questions as well. So let's fire away with our first question this week, which is from Ella.
Hi, Damon. I wanted to ask you, if you could pick any three drivers in the history of F1, old or current, to race against, who would they be and why? And on which circuit would you want the race to happen?
Ella, that's an interesting question, isn't it? Yeah, I'm going to have to think about that for a second. But fortunately, I've got George Russell here, who can also jump in and answer those questions for you. I'm sure you've already thought this through, haven't you, George? You know, which circuit, the three drivers of all time, which ones would you like to race? I mean, the point is, you don't really want to race against anyone, do you? Rather, you know, the problem is, they're all so good. You know, you want an easy guy to drive against, don't you?
That's the thing. I mean, if you had your pick, you'd choose the easier bunch to give you more chance of winning. But from my side, I want to go against the best. So statistically, you've got to say Lewis, Michael Schumacher and Ayrton Senna. I'd say they're the three that sort of stand out for me. As for the circuit, I guess Silverstone, home crowd, home race, great circuit. Maybe I'll have an advantage there.
Good one. You just defended Fernando Alonso, you know that. But then you have raced against Fernando Alonso. But anyway, you've done that. You've done him, ticked him off the box. So I would say I'm going to go back in time a little bit. And I would like to see how I compare to someone like Fangio or someone like Clark. But, you know, I was very lucky, actually, in some ways, because I've already raced against Alan Prost, Ayrton Senna and Nigel Mansell. So I've got three in the bag there. And I raced against Michael Schumacher as well. So I've had quite a few tough ones to have a go at. So I've already had my three. And the circuit would be, for me, because my best ever race was on Suzuka in the wet. I wouldn't want to do it again. But what a great place to race if you can get a good race in there.
I'd be happy with Damon Hill, Johnny Herbert, Sandown Park karting Wednesday. That'll do me.
See you there. You're invited, Tom. Come along.
Great stuff. What about question two? Who have we got?
Hi, Damon. This is Nicholas from Madrid. Let's talk helmets for a second. Your father had a fantastic helmet design, which I believe he borrowed from a rowing club. Maybe you could clarify that. It was black with white vertical bars. You, of course, used the same one throughout your career. Back in your day, drivers were instantly recognisable from their helmets. We can think of Senna's famous yellow helmet, Mansell's, Prost's, yours. That's not the case anymore. My question is, should drivers be obliged to maintain their helmet design throughout their career, rather like they have to do with the numbers? Or should we just let them do what they're doing now, which is a bit messy, I think. Thanks, Damon.
Well, Nicholas, actually, I just want to correct him on slightly on one thing. The helmet that I wore was not black. It was navy blue, dark navy blue. So it looks quite dark, but actually it's navy blue. And it was my dad's helmet design, which he picked up. Basically, he decided to use that. He rode for the London Rowing Club, and that was their cap design. And the white stripes represent oarsmen on the boat. So they have eight stripes on it. And I carried that on, as did my son. And so we've had three generations wearing the same design, which was consistent and also quite conservative. I don't think it's a patch on what they get up to now. But George is, honestly, I don't know. How many times have you changed your crash helmet design, George?
I've kind of kept the same theme over the past few years, but definitely not quite as standout as back in the day. And I do regret that slightly. I am trying to find a way to make it a bit more standout, a bit more clear, iconic, because I do agree with Nicholas's point. You know, you do want to be recognizable from your crash helmet, but obviously slightly difficult these days with the halo there, obviously for safety reasons. It's not quite as out in the open as they were in your day. So
sponsors' logos as well slightly ruin them now, don't they? There's more sponsors' logos than in your day, Damon, aren't there?
Yeah, no, I had a bit of a discussion with Frank about that, because he said, do you mind if I, you know, splash stickers all over your crash helmet? So I had to object, and he actually backed off quite quickly on that, but it was quite good. But I don't know how much it cost him, or me. Probably should have just said, how much do you want? But I didn't.
Great stuff, George. Thank you very much for your time. It's great to have you on the show. Great to get these two Williams legends together. Really enjoyed hearing you have a chat, and best of luck this weekend at Silverstone.
Thank you very much, guys. Have a good one.
All the best, George.
Thanks a lot.
Cheers.
Well, DH, I feel we've got a bit of an exclusive from George. He's not signing for Mercedes yet.
Now, what did he actually say? It won't be announced this weekend, or he's not signed. I can't remember. It won't.
DH, he did slip into the conversation. Yeah, next year, when I'm hopefully fighting for the World Championship. Did you hear him say that? And I found myself thinking, gosh, well, Williams will have taken a big step forward, or is he driving a Mercedes?
I think he will be driving for Mercedes, and I've said that before, but I don't actually know.
He's excited about the sprint qualifying as well, which is great. And I think both Damon and I are as well, aren't we, DH?
Yeah, I'm definitely excited. I think it's brilliant. I mean, you know, Friday can be a kind of not so interesting day. I mean, it's testing, basically, Friday currently. So I think they're getting away from a wasted day. And now they're going to have an opportunity to promote F1.
What about the main race on Sunday? Who is it going to suit? What have we learnt over the last few races in terms of Has the pendulum swung irreversibly towards Red Bull, or can Mercedes get it back?
I think it's going to be very close. My guess is that Mercedes will have a more competitive car relative to the one they had in the Red Bull ring, because this is their circuit. This is a circuit that they've done very well at. But these, you know, it's going to come down to whether the tyres can take it. We've had several occasions with Silverstone where the tyres have had failures. So going long on a set of tyres might not be an attractive option. But it's so close to call, and there's a lot to play for. Lewis needs a good result, let's be honest.
Absolutely does. But going with what we know, Mercedes are bringing an upgrade package to this race. Is it going to be enough? Lewis was expressing a little bit of doubt after the last race. And I think when you look at Red Bull and the downforce that high rake generates, and allowing them to run a little bit less rear wing, it's going to be like a bullet down the hangar straight, down the Wellington straight as well. I just think the Red Bull just looks an unstoppable force. And full of at Goodwood over the weekend, Damon, someone close to Adrian Newey, I'm not going to mention their name, said he is working harder now than maybe he's ever worked. Adrian, I'm talking about. And that didn't specify what projects necessarily.
He loves to win. You know, he is a competitor. Adrian is an incredibly intensely driven designer. He's not just a designer. He wants to win, and he wants to be in a race team that wins. He doesn't like being shown up, and if he smells victory, then he will work very hard. And he's been going for quite a long time now at this. I mean, it's he's racking up the championships. I mean, I don't know, but I mean, he's still motivated as ever.
Yeah, and Red Bull have won the last five races. They won one of the races at Silverstone last year. Let's not forget that, the 70th anniversary race there. So it will be fascinating. As you say, Lewis needs to win. What about the battle further back, Damon? This one between McLaren and Ferrari. How do you see that one now?
Well, I'd be interested. I think, as Carlos was saying, you know, they don't know what to expect with Ferrari. They turn up at a circuit. One minute it's great, next minute it's not. Or qualifies well and then races badly. So Ferrari are all over the place, up and down. But they should have the potential to be good at Silverstone. They've been strong in the past at Silverstone. But I do think that McLaren are on the march. They are definitely creeping further and further, closer and closer to the guys at the front end. I mean, they very, very nearly had pole position in the Austrian Grand Prix.
But in the way that you said you think Mercedes will be more competitive at Silverstone than they were at the Red Bull Ring, do we think McLaren will be less competitive at Silverstone than they were at the Red Bull Ring?
I don't see anything that suggests they won't be. I mean, they've got a Mercedes engine, and that is a strong engine, but it might not be as good as the Honda now. But it's come down to balance, and it comes down to tyres, and it comes down to, of course, the format we've got now. So Lando has been qualifying brilliantly. So he's got a really good opportunity, I think, in the Friday qualifying for the sprint qualifier. They must be jumping up and down with excitement about this.
Well, certainly Lando. He actually said at Goodwood, he said, I'll take some DNFs for the rest of the year if I can get a decent result at Silverstone. That is how much it means. I think he was exaggerating, but he's really excited about what he can do next weekend.
Bold talk. He won't be saying that if he doesn't, if he crashes out of the qualifying sprint. Qualifying.
Sprint, that's right. No, correct. Stefano will be pleased.
I'm getting the hang of it.
And Daniel Ricciardo, we talk about him most weeks, it seems. So much of Silverstone is high speed. How hard is it to get the car to your liking? Because Daniel struggled everywhere this year to get the McLaren to his liking. Is Silverstone hard or one of the easier tracks to find a decent balance?
Well, they're all difficult, Tom. You know, they're all so, I mean, Silverstone is a high loading racetrack. It's a very grippy circuit and it's very fast. So you are really just, you know, having to be comfortable with a car that's heavily loaded. And some of it can be, you know, muscle. Some of it literally can be the seat of the pants bravery at Silverstone that comes into play. And precision, getting the car to go through the Beckett section, you know, it's easy to get a sequence of corners and have the wrong line. So I think that I think that it's not a circuit where you can find time in small adjustments in slow corners. You know, they're distant, aren't they? So that it's all you're rolling along at high speed the whole time. So you've got to get the car set up for high loads and also fast corners. And if you're confident in the car, then you can extract time. You can extract a lot of time.
And if you're not confident in the car, which seems to be the case with Daniel, do you expect the gap between him and Lando to increase?
Yeah, but I'm saying that I think that in a faster circuit, it's not so much. Sometimes you can lose a lot more when the car is actually in slower corners because the car doesn't give any feedback. It's much easier to get feedback, I think, when you're in a faster track because the car is going to stick. It might jump around a bit, but it's going to stick. I mean, it is coming good, I think, for Seb now. It seems to be coming, he seems to have worked his way out of the doldrum. And also Aston Martin are looking like a stronger team. They've got their heads down now and seem to be looking forwards and doing reasonably well. I mean, whether they will be a contender for, you know, midfield results, I think it could well be in the top eight, you know, possibly. I think that could be a strong result for them.
Yeah, well, and they've really closed the gap on AlphaTauri in the Constructors' Championship. They're currently sixth, just 4 points behind AlphaTauri. So they'll be hoping to do something about that. But of course, it was at Silverstone last year that we think Sebastian Vettel signed for the team. There was that little bit of footage of him, so not high-fiving, what was he doing? Elbowing Lawrence Stroll as he walked past. And Seb was also spotted in Otmar Safnauer's Ferrari going to some service station or something. So, yeah, there's sort of the anniversary of Seb making the jump. And it will be great to see Aston Martin racing at home, British Racing Green, although it's not British Racing Green, is it? They've actually said recently they're going to pimp it up and do something to it to make it more TV friendly. But anyway, let's call it British Racing Green. It's going to be a special moment. I'm looking forward to seeing them. We normally do any other business at this point in the show, and there is another thing happening at Silverstone as well. If sprint qualifying wasn't enough, because we're going to get a glance at a full-scale, life-size 2022 Formula One car on Thursday.
Where's that going to be? Because I want to see that.
Yeah, well, I think it's going to be on the grid. I'll see.
I've heard that some of the designers have kind of up in arms about it. They're going, oh, it's gone backwards and everything. But I think I'm interested. I'm really, really interested in seeing, because this is going to change Formula One massively. It could even change the order. So you're looking at the future of Formula One, and the cars are going to look different. They're going to have low profile tyres on them. They're bigger wheels, but skinnier sidewalls, and it's going to look different. I think it's very exciting.
Yeah, and Alex Albon was at Goodwood at the weekend, and he was saying he's doing a lot of sim work with the 2022 car, and he says it's great to drive.
Well, that
car
good.
Is really nice to drive. He said it's not as quick. It's not as quick as what we've got now, but it's got a really nice feel to it. So the combination of what Alex said to me at the weekend and seeing the car on Thursday, very, very excited. I'm sure we'll see Adrian Newey out there as well.
Of course, it's not really about the car itself, is it? It's about the racing. So the design has been modified to make racing better. And we have yet to see, because obviously with one car, you can't find out whether it works or not. So they'll have to have two cars out there pretty soon testing to see whether they've got the result they wanted, which is a car's able to get close to each other in the corners.
DH, imagine that. You and Johnny Herbert employed to drive the 2022 cars closely together to see how the aero works when you're following another car. That would be good, wouldn't it?
I think that might be pushing our luck a little bit. But no, I think, Tom, no, I will not be development driver for the 2022 car. And I might be preempting Johnny, but I think maybe Johnny won't be putting his hand up for that either.
Well, look, I've got another potential job for you then, Damon, because I found out recently that McLaren are bringing back their V10 Formula One two-seater.
Crumbs.
Do you remember that it was the late 90s and they had the silver two-seater car. Martin Brundle did a lot of the driving back then, taking Murray Walker and lots of McLaren VIPs around. Well, that car is coming back and they're looking for a driver.
So why are they doing this? Is this to be run at race meetings so that people can have...
Maybe run at race meetings, or I don't know whether they just... It's a chance to ferry VIPs around.
Gosh. Okay.
And it's quick. A lap of Silverstone in 1998. I think the car was about 10 seconds off what it would have, a qualifying lap
that
around
there. Plenty so, fast enough for you, Tom.
Yeah.
Don't you worry.
I want to be driven
Don't
by worry. You. I'm going to suggest this.
Listen, the last time I took someone in the back of a two-seater car, they wanted to be a racing driver. That was my son. It cost me a fortune. That he had showed no sign of any interest in until I took him around Silverstone in a two-seater. And then he went, that
in a
was
what,
a,
what were you driving?
That was a GP Masters car, actually. It wasn't a Formula One car, but it was fastish. Yeah, he jumped out and said, oh, that was great. I want to be a racing driver. So I don't want to do the same to you, Tom. I don't want you suddenly getting big ideas.
Do you know what? I'll end up being like that guy, Wade Eastwood, Tom Cruise's stunt double, who at the age of 50 decided that he wanted to be a racing driver. So he raced in British Formula 3 last year. Age 50, yes.
Oh, well, he's actually not the oldest Formula driver. There was Ronnie Grant, the famous taxi driver, who was 70 when I was racing against him. And he's still going, and I hear from his son every now and then. Lovely, lovely chap.
Yeah. Well, I'll see you soon. Couple of days up at the Stone.
Yes, settling in, and I'm camping up this time. I'm not going outside the circuit, so I'll be inside the circuit for the whole weekend.
Hang on, that's exciting. You're camping.
Well, I say camping. I'm clamping. I'm in a very... you know, plush motorhome.
So, what, in the BRDC campsite or something?
I'm in the BRDC campsite. So that means I have to do my own cooking. So you're very welcome. I don't know if you're allowed in the bubble, you can come around for bacon and not bacon because I'm vegetarian, but beans on toast.
Barbie with Damon. Well, we will reconvene after the British Grand Prix for our debrief. Nat's back next week.
Mm.
She's having a holiday, would you believe it, this week?
Gosh.
Be great to have Nat back. And DH, I can never remember what your email address is for Ask Damon, but please keep the questions coming in. What's the email address again?
Oh, the email address for Ask Damon Hill is askdamonhill@gmail.com. And you have to send in a voice recording, not an email, not a written one. And we'd be delighted to try and answer it.
F1 Nation is produced...
in association... with Audioboom. No.
By F1.
I can do this on my own. Listen to this.
Go on, do it. Okay.
F1 Nation is produced by F1 in association with Audioboom.
And we'll see everybody after Silverstone and hopefully see lots of you at the track because the fans are back. Can't wait to see you all.
Wave.
Thanks for selling your car to Carvana. Here's your check.
Whoa, when did I get here?
What do you mean?
I swear it was just moments ago that I accepted a great offer from Carvana online. I must have time traveled to the future.
It was just moments ago. We do same day pickup. Here's your check for that great offer.
It is the future.
It's the present and just the convenience of Carvana. Sorry to blow your mind.
It's all good. Happens all the time.
Sell your car the convenient way to
Carvana.
Pickup times may vary and fees may apply.